6. The Greek mathematic, as a science of perceivable magnitudes, deliberately confines itself to facts of the comprehensibly present and limits its researches and their validity to the near and the small. As compared with this impeccable consistency, the position of the Western mathematic is seen to be, practically, somewhat illogical, though it is only since the discovery of non-Euclidean geometry that the fact has been really recognized. Numbers are images of the perfectly desensualized understanding, of pure thought, and contain their abstract validity within themselves. Their exact application to the actuality of conscious experience is therefore a problem in itself, a problem which is always being posed anew and never solved, and the congruence of mathematical system with empirical observation is at present anything but self-evident. Although the lay idea, as found in Schopenhauer, is that mathematics rest upon the direct evidences of the senses, Euclidean geometry, superficially identical though it is with the popular geometry of all ages, is only in agreement with the phenomenal world approximately and within very narrow limits, in fact, the limits of a drawing board. Extend these limits, and what becomes, for instance, of Euclidean parallels? They meet at the line of the horizon, a simple fact upon which all our art perspective is grounded. Now, it is unpardonable that Kant, a Western thinker, should have evaded the mathematic of distance and appealed to a set of figure examples that their mere pettiness excludes from treatment by the specifically Western infinitesimal methods. But Euclid, as a thinker of the classical age, was entirely consistent with its spirit when he refrained from proving the phenomenal truth of his axioms by referring to, say, the triangle formed by an observer and two infinitely distant fixed stars. For these can neither be drawn nor intuitively apprehended, and his feeling was precisely the feeling which shrank from the irrationals, which did not dare to give nothingness a value as zero, i.e., a number, and even in the contemplation of cosmic relations, shut its eyes to the infinite and held to its symbol of proportion. Aristarchus of Samos, who in 288 to 277 belonged to a circle of astronomers at Alexandria that doubtless had relations with Chaldeo-Persian schools, projected the elements of a heliocentric world system. Footnote. In the only writing of his that survives, indeed, Aristarchus maintains the geocentric view. It may be presumed, therefore, that it was only temporarily that he let himself be captivated by a hypothesis of the Chaldean learning. End of footnote. Rediscovered by Copernicus, it was to shake the metaphysical passions of the West to their foundations, witness Giordano Bruno, to become the fulfilment of mighty premonitions, and to justify that Faustian, Gothic world-feeling which had already professed its faith in infinity through the forms of its cathedrals. But the world of Aristarchus received his work with entire indifference, and in a brief space of time it was forgotten, designedly, we may surmise. His few followers were nearly all natives of Asia Minor, his most prominent supporter, Seleucus, about 150, being from the Persian Seleucia on Tigris. In fact, the Aristarchian system had no spiritual appeal to the classical culture, and might indeed have become dangerous to it. And yet it was differentiated from the Copernican, a point always missed, by something which made it perfectly conformable to the classical world-feeling, viz., the assumption that the cosmos is contained in a material finite and optically appreciable hollow sphere, in the middle of which the planetary system, arranged as such on Copernican lines, moved. In the classical astronomy, the Earth and the heavenly bodies are consistently regarded as entities of two different kinds, however variously their movements in detail might be interpreted. Equally, the opposite idea that the Earth is only a star among stars is not inconsistent in itself with either the Ptolemaic or the Copernican systems, and in fact was pioneered by Nicolaus Cusanus and Leonardo da Vinci. But by this device of a celestial sphere, the principle of infinity, which would have endangered the sensuous classical notion of bounds, was smothered. One would have supposed that the infinity conception was inevitably implied by the system of Aristarchus. Long before his time, the Babylonian thinkers had reached it. But no such thought emerges. On the contrary, in the famous treatise on the grains of sand, Archimedes proves that the filling of this stereometric body, for that is what Aristarchus's cosmos is, after all, with atoms of sand, leads to very high but not to infinite figure results. This proposition, quoted though it may be time and again as being a first step towards the integral calculus, amounts to a denial, implicit indeed in the very title, of everything that we mean by the word analysis. Whereas in our physics, the constantly surging hypotheses of a material, i.e. directly cognizable ether, break themselves one after the other against our refusal to acknowledge material limitations of any kind. Eudoxus, Apollonius, and Archimedes, certainly the keenest and boldest of the classical mathematicians, completely worked out, in the main with rule and compass, a purely optical analysis of things become on the basis of sculptural classical bounds. They used deeply thought out, and for us hardly understandable, methods of integration. But these possess only a superficial resemblance even to Leibniz's definite integral method. They employed geometrical loci and coordinates, but these are always specified lengths and units of measurement, and never, as in Fermat and above all in Descartes, unspecified spatial relations, values of points in terms of their positions in space. With these methods also should be classed the exhaustion method of Archimedes, given by him in his recently discovered letter to Eratosthenes on such subjects as the quadrature of the parabola section by means of inscribed rectangles, instead of through similar polygons. But the very subtlety and extreme complication of his methods, which are grounded in certain of Plato's geometrical ideas, make us realize, in spite of superficial analogies, what an enormous difference separates him from Pascal. Apart altogether from the idea of Riemann's integral, what sharper contrast could there be to these ideas than the so-called quadratures of today? The name itself is now no more than an unfortunate survival. The surface is indicated by a bounding function, and the drawing as such has vanished. Nowhere else did the two mathematical minds approach each other more closely than in this instance, and nowhere is it more evident that the gulf between the two souls thus expressing themselves is impassable. In the cubic style of their early architecture, the Egyptians, so to say, concealed pure numbers, fearful of stumbling upon their secret, and for the Hellenes, too, they were the key to the meaning of the become, the stiffened, the mortal. The stone statue and the scientific system deny life. Mathematical number, the formal principle of an extension world of which the phenomenal existence is only the derivative and servant of waking human consciousness, bears the hallmark of causal necessity, and so is linked with death as chronological number is with becoming, with life, with the necessity of destiny. This connection of strict mathematical form with the end of organic being, with the phenomenon of its organic remainder, the corpse, we shall see more and more clearly to be the origin of all great art. We have already noticed the development of early ornament on funerary equipments and receptacles. Numbers are symbols of the mortal. Stiff forms are the negation of life. Formulae and laws spread rigidity over the face of nature, numbers make dead, and the mothers of Faust II sit enthroned, majestic and withdrawn, in the realms of image unconfined, formation, transformation, eternal play of the eternal mind, with semblances of all things in creation, forever and forever sweeping round. Goethe draws very near to Plato in this divination of one of the final secrets. For his unapproachable mothers are Plato's ideas, the possibilities of a spirituality, the unborn forms to be realized as active and purposed culture, as art, thought, polity, and religion, in a world ordered and determined by that spirituality. And so the number thought and the world idea of a culture are related, and by this relation, the former is elevated above mere knowledge and experience and becomes a view of the universe, there being consequently as many mathematics, as many number worlds, as there are higher cultures. Only so can we understand, as something necessary, the fact that the greatest mathematical thinkers, the creative artists of the realm of numbers, have been brought to the decisive mathematical discoveries of their several cultures by a deep religious intuition. Classical Apollinean number we must regard as the creation of Pythagoras, who founded a religion. It was an instinct that guided Nicolaus Cusanus, the great bishop of Brixen, about 1450, from the idea of the unendingness of God in nature to the elements of the infinitesimal calculus. Leibniz himself, who 2 centuries later definitely settled the methods and notation of the calculus, was led by purely metaphysical speculations about the divine principle and its relation to infinite extent to conceive and develop the notion of an analysis situs, probably the most inspired of all interpretations of pure and emancipated space, the possibilities of which were to be developed later by Grassmann in his Ausdehnungslehre, and above all by Riemann, their real creator, in his symbolism of two-sided planes representative of the nature of equations. And Kepler and Newton, strictly religious natures both, were and remained convinced, like Plato, that it was precisely through the medium of number that they had been able to apprehend intuitively the essence of the divine world order. 7. The classical arithmetic, we are always told, was first liberated from its sense bondage, widened and extended by Diophantus, who did not indeed create algebra, the science of undefined magnitudes, but brought it to expression within the framework of the classical mathematic that we know, and so suddenly that we have to assume that there was a pre-existent stock of ideas which he worked out. But this amounts not to an enrichment of, but a complete victory over, the classical world feeling, and the mere fact should have sufficed in itself to show that, inwardly, Diophantus does not belong to the classical culture at all. What is active in him is a new number feeling, or let us say a new limit feeling, with respect to the actual and become, and no longer that Hellenic feeling of sensuously present limits which had produced the Euclidean geometry, the nude statue, and the coin. Details of the formation of this new mathematic we do not know. Diophantus stands so completely by himself in the history of so-called late classical mathematics that an Indian influence has been presumed. But here also the influence must really have been that of those early Arabian schools whose studies, apart from the dogmatic, have hitherto been so imperfectly investigated. In Diophantus, unconscious though he may be of his own essential antagonism to the classical foundations on which he attempted to build, there emerges from under the surface of Euclidean intention the new limit feeling, which I designate the Magian. He did not widen the idea of number as magnitude, but unwittingly eliminated it. No Greek could have stated anything about an undefined number alpha, or an undenominated number 3, which are neither magnitudes nor lines, Whereas the new limit feeling, sensibly expressed by numbers of this sort, at least underlay, if it did not constitute, diophantine treatment. And the letter notation which we employ to clothe our own, again transvalued, algebra, was first introduced by Vieta in 1591, an unmistakable, if unintended, protest against the classicizing tendency of Renaissance mathematics. Diophantus lived about 250 AD, that is, in the 3rd century of that Arabian culture whose organic history, till now smothered under the surface forms of the Roman Empire and the Middle Ages, comprises everything that happened after the beginning of our era in the region that was later to be Islam's. It was precisely in the time of Diophantus that the last shadow of the Attic statuary art paled before the new space sense of cupola, mosaic, and sarcophagus relief that we have in the early Christian Syrian style. At that time, there was once more archaic art and strictly geometrical ornament. And at that time, too, Diocletian completed the transformation of the now merely sham empire into a caliphate. The 4 centuries that separate Euclid and Diophantus separate also Plato and Plotinus, the last and conclusive thinker, the Kant of a fulfilled culture, and the first schoolman, the Duns Scotus of a culture just awakened. It is here that we are made aware for the first time of the existence of those higher individualities whose coming, growth, and decay constitute the real substance of history underlying the myriad colours and changes of the surface. The classical spirituality, which reached its final phase in the cold intelligence of the Romans, and of which the whole classical culture, with all its works, thoughts, deeds, and ruins, forms the body, had been born about 1100 BC in the country about the Aegean Sea. The Arabian culture, which under cover of the classical civilization had been germinating in the East since Augustus, came wholly out of the region between Armenia and southern Arabia, Alexandria and Ctesiphon. And we have to consider as expressions of this new soul almost the whole late classical art of the empire, all the young, ardent religions of the East, Mandeanism, Manichaeism, Christianity, Neoplatonism, and in Rome itself, as well as the imperial fora, that pantheon which is the first of all mosques. That Alexandria and Antioch still wrote in Greek, and imagined that they were thinking in Greek, is a fact of no more importance than the facts that Latin was the scientific language of the West right up to the time of Kant, and that Charlemagne renewed the Roman Empire. In Diophantus, number has ceased to be the measure and essence of plastic things. In the Ravennate mosaics, man has ceased to be a body. Unnoticed, Greek designations have lost their original connotations. We have left the realm of Attic kalokagathia, nobleness and goodness, the Stoic ataraxia, tranquility or equanimity, and galene, calm tranquility. Diophantus does not yet know zero and negative numbers, it is true, but he has ceased to know Pythagorean numbers. And this Arabian indeterminateness of number is, in its turn, something quite different from the controlled variability of the later Western mathematics, the variability of the function. The Magian mathematic, we can see the outline, though we are ignorant of the details, advanced through Diophantus, who is obviously not a starting point, boldly and logically to a culmination in the Abbasid period, 9th century, that we can appreciate in Al-Khwarizmi and Al-Sidshi. And as Euclidean geometry is to Attic statuary, the same expression form in a different medium, and the analysis of space to polyphonic music, so this algebra is to the Magian art with its mosaic, its arabesque, which the Sassanid Empire and later Byzantium produced with an ever-increasing profusion and luxury of tangible, intangible organic motives, and its Constantinian high relief in which uncertain deep darks divide the freely handled figures of the foreground. As algebra is to classical arithmetic and Western analysis, so is the cupola church to the Doric temple and the Gothic cathedral. It is not as though Diophantus were one of the great mathematicians. On the contrary, much of what we have been accustomed to associate with his name is not his work alone. His accidental importance lies in the fact that, so far as our knowledge goes, he was the first mathematician in whom the new number feeling is unmistakably present. In comparison with the masters who conclude the development of a mathematic, with Apollonius and Archimedes, with Gauss, Cauchy, Riemann, Diophantus has, in his form language especially, something primitive. This something, which till now we have been pleased to refer to late classical decadence, we shall presently learn to understand and value, just as we are revising our ideas as to the despised late classical art and beginning to see in it the tentative expression of the nascent early Arabian culture. Similarly archaic, primitive and groping was the mathematic of Nicolas Oresme, Bishop of Lisieux, 1323-1382, who was the first Western who used coordinates, so to say, elastically, and more important still, to employ fractional powers, both of which presuppose a number feeling, obscure it may be, but quite unmistakable, which is completely non-classical and also non-Arabic. But if, further, we think of Diophantus, together with the early Christian sarcophagi of the Roman collections, and of Oresme, together with the Gothic wall statuary of the German cathedrals, we see that the mathematicians, as well as the artists, have something in common, which is that they stand in their respective cultures at the same, viz. The primitive, level of abstract understanding. In the world and age of Diophantus, the stereometric sense of bounds, which had long ago reached in Archimedes the last stages of refinement and elegance proper to the megalopolitan intelligence, had passed away. Throughout that world, men were unclear, longing, mystic, and no longer bright and free in the Attic way. They were men rooted in the earth of a young countryside, not megalopolitans like Euclid and D'Alembert. Footnote: Alexandria ceased to be a world city in the 2nd century AD and became a collection of houses left over from the classical civilization, which harboured a primitive population of quite different spiritual constitution. End of footnote. They no longer understood the deep and complicated forms of the classical thought, and their own were confused and new, far as yet from urban clarity and tidiness. Their culture was in the Gothic condition, as all cultures have been in their youth, as even the classical was in the early Doric period, which is known to us now only by its dipylon pottery. Only in Baghdad in the 9th and 10th centuries were the young ideas of the age of Diophantus carried through to completion by ripe masters of the calibre of Plato and Gauss. 8. The decisive act of Descartes, whose geometry appeared in 1637, consisted not in the introduction of a new method or idea in the domain of traditional geometry, as we are so frequently told, but in the definitive conception of a new number idea, which conception was expressed in the emancipation of geometry from servitude to optically realizable constructions and to measured and measurable lines generally. With that, the analysis of the infinite became a fact. The rigid, so-called Cartesian, system of coordinates, a semi-Euclidean method of ideally representing measurable magnitudes, had long been known, witness Oresme, and regarded as of high importance. And when we get to the bottom of Descartes' thought, we find that what he did was not to round off the system, but to overcome it. Its last historic representative was Descartes' contemporary, Fermat, born 1601, died 1665. In place of the sensuous element of concrete lines and planes, the specific character of the classical feeling of bounds, there emerged the abstract, spatial, unclassical element of the point, which from then on was regarded as a group of co-ordered pure numbers. The idea of magnitude and of perceivable dimension, derived from classical texts and Arabian traditions, was destroyed and replaced by that of variable relation values between positions in space. It is not in general realized that this amounted to the supersession of geometry, which thenceforward enjoyed only a fictitious existence behind a facade of classical tradition. The word geometry has an inextensible Apollinean meaning, and from the time of Descartes, what is called the new geometry is made up in part of synthetic work upon the position of points in a space which is no longer necessarily three-dimensional, a manifold of points, and in part of analysis in which numbers are defined through point positions in space. And this replacement of lengths by positions carries with it a purely spatial and no longer a material conception of extension. The clearest example of this destruction of the inherited optical finite geometry seems to me to be the conversion of angular functions, which in the Indian mathematic had been numbers, in a sense of the word that is hardly accessible to our minds, into periodic functions, and their passage thence into an infinite number realm, in which they become series, and not the smallest trace remains of the Euclidean figure. In all parts of that realm, the circle number pi, like the Napierian base E, generates relations of all sorts which obliterate all the old distinctions of geometry, trigonometry, and algebra, which are neither arithmetical nor geometrical in their nature, and in which no one any longer dreams of actually drawing circles or working out powers. 9. At the moment exactly corresponding to that at which, circa 540, the classical soul in the person of Pythagoras discovered its own proper Apollinean number, the measurable magnitude, the Western soul in the persons of Descartes and his generation, Pascal, Fermat, Desargues, discovered a notion of number that was the child of a passionate Faustian tendency towards the infinite. Number as pure magnitude, inherent in the material presentness of things, is paralleled by numbers as pure relation. Footnote. Similarly, coinage and double-entry bookkeeping play analogous parts in the money thinking of the classical and the Western cultures, respectively. End of footnote. And if we may characterize the classical world, the cosmos, as being based on a deep need of visible limits and composed accordingly as a sum of material things, so we may say that our world picture is an actualizing of an infinite space in which things visible appear very nearly as realities of a lower order, limited in the presence of the illimitable. The symbol of the West is an idea of which no other culture gives even a hint, the idea of function. The function is anything rather than an expansion of, it is complete emancipation from, any pre-existent idea of number. With the function, not only the Euclidean geometry, and with it the common human geometry of children and laymen based on everyday experience, but also the Archimedean arithmetic cease to have any value for the really significant mathematics of Western Europe. Henceforward, this consisted solely in abstract analysis. For classical man, geometry and arithmetic were self-contained and complete sciences of the highest rank, both phenomenal and both concerned with magnitudes that could be drawn or numbered. For us, on the contrary, those things are only practical auxiliaries of daily life. Addition and multiplication, The two classical methods of reckoning magnitudes have, like their sister geometrical drawing, utterly vanished in the infinity of functional processes. Even the power, which in the beginning denotes numerically a set of multiplications, products of equal magnitudes, is, through the exponential idea, logarithm, and its employment in complex, negative and fractional forms, dissociated from all connection with magnitude and transferred to a transcendent relational world which the Greeks, knowing only the two positive whole number powers that represent areas and volumes, were unable to approach. Think, for instance, of expressions like e to the power of minus x, pith root of x, a times x over I. Every one of the significant creations which succeeded one another so rapidly from the Renaissance onward, imaginary and complex numbers introduced by Cardanus as early as 1550, infinite series established theoretically by Newton's great discovery of the binomial theorem in 1666, the differential geometry, the definite integral of Leibniz, the aggregate as a new number unit, hinted at even by Descartes, new processes like those of general integrals, the expansion of functions into series and even into infinite series of other functions, is a victory over the popular and sensuous number feeling in us, a victory which the new mathematic had to win in order to make the new world feeling actual. In all history so far, there is no second example of one culture paying to another culture long extinguished such reverence and submission in matters of science as ours has paid to the classical. It was very long before we found courage to think our proper thought. But though the wish to emulate the classical was constantly present, every step of the attempt took us, in reality, further away from the imagined ideal. The history of Western knowledge is thus one of progressive emancipation from classical thought, an emancipation never willed but enforced in the depths of the unconscious. And so the development of the new mathematic consists of a long, secret, and finally victorious battle against the notion of magnitude. The same may be said in the matter of Roman law and of coinage. 10. One result of this classicizing tendency has been to prevent us from finding the new notation proper to our Western number as such. The present-day sign language of mathematics perverts its real content. It is principally owing to that tendency that the belief in numbers as magnitudes still rules today, even amongst mathematicians, for is it not the base of all our written notation? But it is not the separate signs, e.g. x, pi, s, serving to express the functions, but the function itself as unit, as element, the variable relation no longer capable of being optically defined, that constitutes the new number. And this new number should have demanded a new notation, built up with entire disregard of classical influences. Consider the difference between two equations, if the same word can be used of two such dissimilar things, such as 3x plus 4x equals 5x, and x to the power of n plus y to the power of n equals z to the power of n, the equation of Fermat's theorem. The first consists of several classical numbers, i.e. magnitudes, but the second is one number of a different sort, veiled by being written down according to Euclidean-Archimedean tradition, in the identical form of the first. In the first case, the sign equals establishes a rigid connection between definite and tangible magnitudes. But in the second, it states that within a domain of variable images, there exists a relation such that, from certain alterations, certain other alterations necessarily follow. The first equation has as its aim the specification by measurement of a concrete magnitude, viz., a result, while the second has, in general, no result, but is simply the picture and sign of a relation which for N strict inequality 2, this is the famous Fermat problem, can probably be shown to exclude integers. Translator's footnote. The Fermat problem is, it is impossible to part a cube into two cubes, a biquadrate into two biquadrates, and generally any power above the square into two powers having the same exponent. Fermat claimed to possess a proof of the proposition, but this has not been preserved, and no general proof has hitherto been obtained. End of translator's footnote. A Greek mathematician would have found it quite impossible to understand the purport of an operation like this, which was not meant to be worked out. As applied to the letters in Fermat's equation, the notion of the unknown is completely misleading. In the first equation, x is a magnitude, defined and measurable, which it is our business to compute. In the second, the word defined has no meaning at all for x, y, z, n, and consequently we do not attempt to compute their values. Hence they are not numbers at all in the plastic sense, but signs representing a connection that is destitute of the hallmarks of magnitude, shape, and unique meaning, an infinity of possible positions of like character, an ensemble unified and so attaining existence as a number. The whole equation, though written in our unfortunate notation as a plurality of terms, is actually one single number, x, y, z being no more numbers than plus and equals are. In fact, directly the essentially anti-Hellenic idea of the irrationals is introduced, the foundations of the idea of number as concrete and definite collapse. Thenceforward, the series of such numbers is no longer a visible row of increasing discrete numbers capable of plastic embodiment, but a unidimensional continuum in which each cut, in Dedekind's sense, represents a number. Such a number is already difficult to reconcile with classical number, for the classical mathematic knows only one number between 1 and 3, whereas for the Western, the totality of such numbers is an infinite aggregate. But when we introduce further the imaginary square root of minus 1, or I, and finally the complex numbers, general form A plus BI, the linear continuum is broadened into the highly transcendent form of a number body, i.e. the content of an aggregate of homogeneous elements in which a cut now stands for a number surface containing an infinite aggregate of numbers of a lower potency, for instance all the real numbers, and there remains not a trace of number in the classical and popular sense. These number surfaces, which since Cauchy and Riemann have played an important part in the theory of functions, are pure thought pictures. Even positive irrational number, for example, the square root of 2, could be conceived in a sort of negative fashion by classical minds. They had, in fact, enough idea of it to ban it as aretos, unknown, secret, abominable, and a logos, silly, without reason, absurd. But expressions of the form x plus yi lie beyond every possibility of comprehension by classical thought, whereas it is on the extension of the mathematical laws over the whole region of the complex numbers, within which these laws remain operative, that we have built up the function theory, which has at last exhibited the Western mathematic in all purity and unity. Not until that point was reached could this mathematic be unreservedly brought to bear in the parallel sphere of our dynamic Western physics. For the classical mathematic was fitted precisely to its own stereometric world of individual objects, and to static mechanics as developed from Leucippus to Archimedes. The brilliant period of the Baroque mathematic, the counterpart of the Ionian, lies substantially in the 18th century, and extends from the decisive discoveries of Newton and Leibniz through Euler, Lagrange, Laplace and D'Alembert to Gauss. Once this immense creation found wings, its rise was miraculous. Men hardly dared believe their senses. The age of refined skepticism witnessed the emergence of one seemingly impossible truth after another. Translator's footnote. Thus, Bishop Berkeley's Discourse Addressed to an Infidel Mathematician, 1735, shrewdly asked whether the mathematician were in a position to criticize the divine for proceeding on the basis of faith. End of translator's footnote. Regarding the theory of the differential coefficient, D'Alembert had to say, "Go forward, and faith will come to you." Logic itself seemed to raise objections and to prove foundations fallacious, but the goal was reached. This century was a very carnival of abstract and immaterial thinking, in which the great masters of analysis, and with them Bach, Gluck, Haydn and Mozart, a small group of rare and deep intellects, revelled in the most refined discoveries and speculations from which Goethe and Kant remained aloof. And in point of content, it is exactly paralleled by the ripest century of the Ionic, the century of Eudoxus and Archytas, 440 to 350, and, we may add, of Phidias, Polycletus, Alcamenes and the Acropolis buildings, in which the form world of classical mathematics and sculpture displayed the whole fullness of its possibilities, and so ended. And now, for the first time, it is possible to comprehend in full the elemental opposition of the classical and the Western souls. In the whole panorama of history, innumerable and intense as historical relations are, we find no two things so fundamentally alien to one another as these. And it is because extremes meet, because it may be there is some deep common origin behind their divergence, that we find in the Western Faustian soul this yearning effort towards the Apollinean ideal, the only alien ideal which we have loved, and, for its power of intensely living in the pure, sensuous present, have envied.